All right. I hope you're prepared for a stream of consciousness today, because that's kind of what it's going to be. I'm just going to be talking off the top of my head, and I hope that I don't rattle on too long and talk about things that may not make sense. But when I try to prepare for these sermons, I always go in with the intention of writing it down and, you know, writing everything, making it perfect, and it never happens. I just can't seem to do it. So I'm going to talk on the topic of justice is what love looks like in public, and what I learned from attending the Pride Parade again this year. Some of you might be saying, oh, he's going to talk about that stuff again. Why doesn't he talk about something else? But this is a topic that is dear to my heart, and this is what I want to talk about this time. Justice is what love looks like in public. Isn't that a great line? It's a very profound line. It's not mine, but it is profound. It's from Dr. Cornel West, who I might say I'm his biggest admirer, but I'm sure there are people that are as big or bigger admirers of him than I am. Cornel West talks about catastrophic love, unconditional love, about how the fact that he is a blues man in the life of the spirit and a jazz man in the life of the intellect. And what does he mean by that? He means that he is a blues man in the fact that his life and the life of African Americans and those people who live in the margins is a life of struggle. It's a life of catastrophe. It's a life of constantly being put down. But people in these margins and in these situations don't respond with violence, usually. They don't respond with counterterrorism. He said there's no African-American equivalent of Al-Qaeda, but they respond as blues men with a lyrical and a musical appreciation, a way to talk about their struggles in a lyrical fashion. And he's a jazz man in the mind of the intellect because he improvises. He learns how to improvise and to use his mind in creative ways to throw off what he refers to as the Jim Crow and Jane Crow society. So justice flows from this unconditional love. People in the margins don't desire to lord over other people and dominate the people that dominate them. People in the margins desire all to be equal and all to be loved. This manifests itself in public. So justice is what love looks like in public. And if you have ever been to a pride parade, you'll know that justice is exactly what love looks like in public. I mentioned in the song, Filled with Loving Kindness, the last line is, may I be whole, or may we be whole. For me, going to the pride parade is a holy pilgrimage. It is a holy and religious experience, because if you get down to the root word of the word, the root definition of the meaning of holy, some dictionaries would say it's sanctified or being with God or being of God, but that's not the original definition of the word holy. It's not the essential definition. And that definition is to be whole, to be who you are, always and forever at that moment. And that's exactly what being at the Pride Parade is. It's being whole. It's being who we are at that moment and that time. It's feeling safe. It's feeling pride for who we are. Rights for the LGBTQ community is the premier civil rights issue of the day. Many leaders would reject that, to say that some people have commandeered the movement, the civil rights movement, for these rights. But as Melissa Lacewell Harris, or Melissa Harris Perry now, excuse me, she was the Ware lecturer last year at the UUA General Assembly. She is a Unitarian Universalist and a political scientist. She spoke this year at the Human Rights Campaign's clergy call and said this: my work is based in the empirical, not the spiritual. As a political scientist, I like data points. I like survey analysis So what am I doing in here in an empirical social scientist straight girl at a clergy call around LGBT issues, she asked. Her answer, I believe that the struggle for equal human and civil rights for lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual, same-sex loving, gender non-conforming, and queer persons is the civil rights agenda of our time. And she said, faith must be part of the work we're doing. Faith must be part of the work we're doing. How do we integrate faith into the secular world? First of all, I'd like to make note that I don't believe in the word secular. I believe that all life is religious in some way, whether you're a Unitarian Universalist, whether you're another faith. But how can we live in a duality that's one time you're religious, and here we're in, maybe when we go to church, we think we're in the religious realm. We go outside in the world, and there's the secular realm. Well, it's all the same. And what we do in here, what we do out there, depends on what we do in here. And even if you don't attend church, or you don't have religious feelings, the universe is the universe, and it all operates together. So to make these distinctions of faith and secular don't make sense to me. Now I'm going to pick on some people here, Catholic bishops, to be specific. After the vote in the New York General Assembly that gave marriage equality in New York State, Archbishop Dolan, who was from St. Louis originally, remarked that he was just very depressed because it was such a bad day that, you know, he was really not feeling well and didn't really want to talk about it. Because although he loves gay people, I have friends who are gay, I love gay people. You know, it doesn't make me homophobic. Well, wrong. To be prejudiced, to deny people rights that are basic human rights, it's not love. It's not love. There is no way that you could ever mask what the men of the church are proclaiming as love. These men of faith are practicing not a faith, but an immoral judgment, an evil judgment, in my opinion. I wanted to share with you a letter that I wrote to Cardinal George in Chicago. And he came out with several, he is the president of the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops and came out with several disparaging letters to give some kind of theological or intellectual reason as to why gay people are not real persons. So I wanted to counteract that to him and to counteract the fact that he believes that women are not real persons. When the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops equated women who attempt ordination with pedophilia, this was a severe blow to all right-thinking persons, to all people who have an intellectual capacity. Anybody that can think for themselves knows that this is just insane. So shortly here, the letter goes, Dear Francis, I don't like titles, I don't use titles. So. People call me Mr., I say, no, my name is John. My birth certificate doesn't say Mr. on there, so sorry. I'm writing to you as a person who once proudly proclaimed, I should preface this too, that I'm a recovering Catholic, so for the others out there, so some people know that, some people don't, so. I'm writing to you as a person who once proudly proclaimed my faith as a Roman Catholic, who took seriously the doctrines of Jesus of Nazareth and believed that he was present to all assembled who freely partook of the holy meal that Jesus asked his followers to do this in remembrance of me. It is with sadness and despair that I must inform you that I no longer believe in the church. But it is with immense joy and fulfillment that I have now discovered that the true meaning of Jesus of Nazareth's invitation to remember is to feed each other, both spiritually and physically, and without regard to any perceived external differences. I believe the church you proclaim has perverted the truth by denying a woman's right to choose her own reproductive health, denying God's call to women who summoned them to be ordained, and denying a dignity and humanity and equality to all persons who are created to be gay, lesbian, transgender, and those who question their sexual identity and their gender identity. You and your brother bishops commit spiritual violence against another person's humanity and true self, and it's an immoral act, an evil act. When you look around the world and search for God, all you see are men who are dressed in scarlet and red, your brother bishops. When I look for God, I see women, men, children, and all shades in between. The church's denial of marriage equality is a denial of God's creation, and your claims of the destruction of marriage sound like the Pharisees who sought to protect their own claims and feared the destruction of their hold on power. Your denial of ordination to women is intellectually lazy, theologically nonsense, and ultimately a denial of God's own call to service. If this letter offends you and your brother bishops, then I am most grateful, because you offend me and all who seek justice in this life. I therefore declare myself excommunicated and thereby free from servitude and religious slavery. I am now, nor have I ever been, in part subject to your interpretation of morality and the natural order. Sincerely, your brother in the Christ of the margins, John Mark Francis Herndon. I got no response to that letter. I think I'm going to have to send it again. Registered mail, maybe, this time. So as I said earlier, my presence at the Pride Parade was my religious pilgrimage. It's my yearly pilgrimage, my faith in action. Because here we see people who have no fear about who they are, no desire to hide in the margins, as we once proclaimed that these people should be. But I got to thinking about why does the heterosexual community resist? Why is there such an aversion to homosexuality? Why does this exist? I mean, you know, I would say as a straight person, I grew up with that mentality around me, but I never really accepted it. But I never really did anything about it either until now. But it was just something that was there. But why, and I got to thinking, why is this? And I think it is basically because it basically comes down to society and the church's opinion that women are second-class citizens. It all comes down to the patriarchy desire to make women less than human. Because it's, you know, men who might seem effeminate or women who are more masculine that this drives these people crazy when they see this and always resisting this lifestyle. So what I would like to move toward is more what Virginia Raimi Mollenkott says is an omnigender society. I was thinking about that, about how, you know, we all have a masculine and a female part to us. And I went to see Harry Potter Friday, Friday morning, took off work, you know, went to work late and went with my wife and a couple friends to see it. And I cried at the end of it. I mean, who wouldn't cry at the end of it? So I love Broadway musicals. I don't deny that. Some people make fun of me because of that, but there is a part in all of us that expresses either what society would say is a traditional feminine role or traditional masculine role. So what about attaining this omnigender status? Well, there's something to be said for that, but there's also something to be said for allowing people to express the gender that they desire, that the gender that they feel that is theirs. Friday night, in an attempt to divert myself from having to work on this, I turned on the television. There's a TV program that was one of my favorites back in the 1980s and 90s called Star Trek: The Next Generation. I don't know if I'm sure you've seen it. I know all the shows by heart, and there was an episode that struck me that night. It was on Friday night. That was just perfect for what I was preparing for this talk. In the episode, they go to a planet where everyone on the planet has no gender, and some people in the planet, though, choose a gender. And when this is discovered, they are arrested, they are prosecuted, and they are counseled, and they are given some, I can't remember what they call it, psychogenic treatment. Sounds like Michelle Bachmann and her husband, I think. But these people are reprogrammed to not pay attention to gender. So one of the, predictably in the story, one of the people in the on this planet falls in love with one of the people in the Star Trek Starship Enterprise, and it's about his trying to get justice for this person. But it's too late, though. By the end, they've already arrested her, put her on trial, and already started the treatment so that she no longer recognizes him or recognizes what she has done as being normal. The judge in the trial states that, we're loving these people. We're doing what's right for these people because they are sick and they are perverted and they need to be treated. So it's a perfect mirror for our society today, or at least the society that was back then. This was a kind of a cutting edge thing for, I think, 1991 it was. So. But I think things are changing, I hope. I think, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the closet is pretty far open now. And I think that door, that closet, is not going to shut ever again. Things are changing, and it's not going back to the way it was before. And people like us need to guard that and protect it. The last time I talked to you back in March, I told you about how, and I got Lane's permission to say this too, so I'll talk about this again, about how I consider myself a straight queer. And I'll explain that a little bit. This comes from the readings that I did with Dr. Carter Hayward, who's a theologian in, used to be at the Episcopal Divinity School in Massachusetts. She's retired now. And she says, the term queer, as I'm using it, let me be clear, is not simply a code word for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and other ways of being at odds with dominant gender culture. Queer is not simply a reversal of a negative epithet so often hurled against GLBT folks in homophobic culture. Queer is not simply a synonym for being odd, unusual, or out there. It's bigger than GLBT lives. Queer is more than a linguistic reversal. And queerness is way deeper than merely odd. It's public solidarity in the struggle for sexual and gender justice, and of irrepressibly making connections to other struggles for justice, compassion, and reconciliation. And she said in their article that Episcopal Divinity School is, by the grace of God, a queer seminary. Well, I would say that First Unitarian Church in Alden is, by the grace of God, a queer church. So there's my stream of consciousness for today. So take it as it is. I'd like to close, however, with the last paragraph of the what I had Jennifer read this morning as the call to worship. I used to not like the word worship at all, because to me worship meant that you were subjecting yourself to someone else, that you were, they're putting something, some supernatural power ahead of your own humanity. But I've come to see that worship is a little bit deeper than that. So that's why I like this paragraph that I had Jennifer read today. And the end goes, worship is loneliness seeking communion. It is thirsty land crying out for rain. Worship is kindred fire within our hearts. It moves through deeds of kindness and through acts of love. Worship is the mystery within us reaching out to the mystery beyond. It is an articulate silence yearning to speak. It is the window of the moment open to the sky of the eternal. And what we did, those of us who attended the Pride Parade, was indeed worship.